This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is humorist and reporter Calvin Trillin. Some of his funniest writing is about food. He calls himself a serious eater, as opposed to a gourmet. This means that rather than making reservations for haute cuisine, he prefers searching out coveted rib joints, fried chicken establishments, and Chinese restaurants. He shared his personal confessions about food and his observations about American dining habits in many of his New Yorker columns. These pieces are collected in three books, which he refers to as his Tummy Trilogy. The books are American Fried, Alice Let's Eat, and Third Helpings. Calvin Trillin also writes a humor column in The Nation magazine, which is one of the most established periodicals on the left. In this column, Uncivil Liberties, Trillin pokes fun at the left, right, and center, and even the magazine itself, especially its editor, Victor Novasky, who Trillin always kids for being cheap. Trillin's second book of columns from The Nation was recently published. It's called With All Disrespect, and it's published by Tickner and Fields. When Trillin was hired at The New Yorker magazine back in 1963, it wasn't as a humorist. He told me how he started writing his humor pieces about food.
When I was doing a piece every 3 weeks for The New Yorker around the country in a series called U.S. Journal, I found that I was kind of wearing down from doing a serious piece every 3 weeks, and I was constantly looking for ways to write in a lighter way about the country. And it just turned out that eating was one of them. In reporting, it really is more possible to talk about, say, eating, or at least the sort of eating I usually talk about, than most other subjects. So that if you went to South Philadelphia and asked people what they thought of the salt talks, you might get some, well, let them handle it, or I don't know, they're all crazy, or something like that. But if you started talking about cheesesteaks, you'd get serious arguments and genuine passion. And the same thing is true if you went to Cincinnati and asked where the best Cincinnati chili was. I've always been more interested in the fact that people in Cincinnati argue about where the best chili is and think chili is a Cincinnati dish made by Greeks, and don't quite understand that people in the Southwest eat chili and can use phrases like authentic Cincinnati chili. I've always been interested in that much more than I have been in actually tasting all the Cincinnati chili. And I find it almost ineffably boring to worry about whether some Cincinnati chili is number two or number three. I mean, that isn't the sort of thing that interests me, but it's the fact that people in Cincinnati argue about it is a nice way to write about a certain part of Cincinnati, a certain part of Cincinnati culture, say. So it really was as a way of writing about the country in a lighter way. And also it turned out that there was a kind of an easy persona, the cheerful glutton, basically, which I fear is not far from the truth. And it made it kind of easy to tell jokes.
Do you think that your interest in food has been misinterpreted by your readers?
By a lot of readers, yes. A lot of people are amazingly solemn about food, have serious arguments, and want to talk about nothing else. And if I'm on a call-in show, we'll call to argue about where the second best rib joint is or where's the best place to get a cup of coffee in New York and that sort of thing. My wife calls them food crazies. A certain number of food crazies who take it all seriously, no matter how often I say, for instance, that I don't actually know anything about it and that I can't cook and that I don't really know what a proper beef Wellington's supposed to taste like or anything like that. It's very hard to convince anybody of that. It's a terrible lesson in how easy it is to become an authority in this country, that even somebody who says, by the way, I don't know anything about this at all, and for me it's kind of a way of telling jokes and I'm having a good time and you ought to enjoy yourself because it's not very serious but it's a lot of fun to eat, is nevertheless asked solemn questions about where the best restaurant is and what I think of the new California cuisine and all that sort of thing.
Do you have any interest in traditional food writing, you know, like restaurant reviews that you find in newspapers?
No, I've never done any of that. I've never read. I'm sometimes asked, well, how do you feel about Gourmet magazine compared to Cuisine magazine or something like that? I've never read Gourmet magazine or Cuisine magazine. But I think I think it's an interesting, eating is an interesting subject because it touches everybody, and often it's funny. I mean, even the fads are funny. I mean, the new American cuisine fad is funny, which basically I think came from the fact that Bloomingdale's ran out of countries, and they, they couldn't have a celebration of France every year, a celebration of Japan, and they couldn't get down to Chad or Upper Volta or Costa Rican celebration, so they found America. And it will go away pretty soon. And I think the California businesses, I was just in San Francisco and admitted that I was relieved to see that there were still pigeons in the squares, because I thought every one of them might have been snatched up and smoked and thrown on a bed of radicchio. But I don't think that I would be very interested in if someone said, well, which is the best of the California restaurants in the East Bay area? It's not only not interested, but I don't have any credentials for that. I don't, if anybody does, but I certainly don't.
You grew up in Kansas City, right?
That's right.
Did you eat a lot of regional foods when you were growing up there?
I didn't know they were regional foods. I thought that's what everybody else ate. I mean, I didn't know there was such a thing as an artichoke or anything like that. I mean, I thought that people ate fried chicken and people ate barbecue ribs. That's what you ate when you went out. And yes, there's definitely, in Kansas City, for instance, I suppose fried chicken and barbecue are the obvious local dishes, but there are any number of places where you would go to eat fried chicken. And in fact, one of the renowned fried chicken cooks of Kansas City, Chicken Betty Lucas, used to have fans following her around when she would move from restaurant to restaurant when she got irritated with the boss or something. She died recently. I'm trying to get a bridge named after her in Kansas City, the Chicken Betty Bridge, but so far I haven't gotten much support from the city council. I want to name the airport after Arthur Bryan, the barbecue man. Bryant Field, I think it sounds a lot better than Kansas City International. It's a very corny name for an airport. But I haven't gotten very far.
You've written about something that you call food nostalgia, in which people return to the place that they're sure made the best hamburger in the world or the best milkshake in the world. Did you have places like that from where you grew up that, that you had to return to?
Oh, yeah. I still return to. And that I said, and I think when I first started writing about food, that the best hamburger in the world was in Kansas City. I also said at the same time that anybody who doesn't think that the best hamburger in the world was in his hometown is a sissy. I mean, it's obviously necessary to think that. So, but I think people have that from all over the country. I mean, I used to bring a certain kind of ice cream from Los Angeles to a friend in New York 20 years ago, and I know people who send Wolferman's English muffins from Kansas City to their children in college thinking they couldn't possibly get along without them. And the mails, I'm sure, are thick with these various things going back and forth.
Were you ever disappointed going back to your hometown and finding that the food really wasn't as good as you remembered?
I would never admit it if I had been.
Right. What kind of food did you eat in your house? What did your mother
leftovers.
Prepare?
We ate leftovers. My mother, for 30 years, served her family nothing but leftovers. It wasn't until I got in college, in fact, that I started wondering, leftover from what? So we now have a team of anthropologists in there looking for the original meal at my mother's. I don't think they're going to find it.
You didn't do any cooking, though?
No.
Yourself. You've never cooked, right?
That's right. I've never cooked. Well, I have a special recipe for scrambled eggs that stick to the pan every time, and I used to make those for the girls every morning for breakfast, because I've always given the girls breakfast because I just happen to get up earlier than my wife. But they finally revolted and said they wouldn't eat them anymore. So now I make hard-boiled eggs. They have a kind of a picnic for breakfast. And I can make meatloaf. Not a particularly renowned meatloaf, just meatloaf.
You have two daughters now.
Yes.
Does it ever drive you mad that they like things like frozen fish sticks when, you know, you're such an adventurous eater yourself?
Well, they're actually getting better.
Are they? They're getting older?
Yes, the older one is quite adventurous now. I mean, for someone who's 16, I think. The younger one would like the world to know that she no longer refuses to go to Chinatown unless she's carrying a bagel. She's definitely outgrown that. And she still does these kind of wild card things so that after refusing to eat practically anything that is at all strange, she'll suddenly look at a plate full of fried alligator and say, I think I'd like to try this and eat a couple of pieces of alligator. So she's very unpredictable. I think she's just trying to keep me off balance. But she still, when we go to Nova Scotia and we stop in the same place every year for lobster, the three of us each have a lobster, and my younger daughter has a tuna fish sandwich. And one of the things I like about her is that she's absolutely shameless about this, and about halfway through the meal she always looks up and says, the tuna fish here is excellent. She doesn't apologize.
My guest is Calvin Trillin. I know that you travel a lot, especially for your New Yorker articles. Do you combine your eating travels with your reporting travels? Or because the two are so different in tone, your reports, you have a whole book about stories that you did on murders, which is surely a very grave subject. Will you ever combine your kind of eating forays with a subject as serious as that?
Well, I think part of the material from eating for the eating books came from being in a place as a stranger, whether you're there to report a murder or anything else, that you still would like to find something to eat that is not the styrofoam food that you would get in the motel that's all cooked in the one great kitchen somewhere hidden in the hills of Virginia. So to that extent, yeah, I'm usually, when I'm, say, in Nebraska at the scene of a killing, still wondering, well, it looks like there may be a good fried chicken restaurant in the next town or something like that. But I don't do things like, while I'm here, I'll write a story about eating or anything like that. I mean, I'm kind of concentrating on what I'm doing usually.
When you're in a new city or a new town, how do you find where you are going to eat for lunch or dinner or whatever?
I try to avoid whatever place the head of the Chamber of Commerce tells me to eat. That's sure to be La Maison de la Casa House Continental Cuisine. In the certain parts of the country, I sniff around for actual hickory wood burning and Mexican restaurants that serve menudo, which is kind of a tripe stew. I don't particularly like menudo, but I think of it as a badge of serious intentions. It's a hangover cure, among other things, among Mexicans. And then my final step, I drift over to the desk of the motel as if I'm going to ask the checkout time or whether you can get laundry back the same day or something like that. And I grab the clerk by his necktie, pull him partway over the counter, and I say, not where you took your parents for their 25th wedding anniversary, the place you went to the night you got home after 5 years in Korea. And those are different places. The second place is very good, usually. First place is La Maison de la Casa House Continental Cuisine. Even he knows it's terrible. So I would say a combination of research and bullying is what I do.
There's some fabulous menu writing now because everything is so dressed up.
Yeah, there's always been a lot of menu writing in La Maison de la Casa House. The main creative employee is the menu writer rather than the chef. Usually you have about a paragraph telling you where the trout came from and what province its sauce was developed in and what's going to sound like sizzling on your plate. The only thing it leaves out is that the poor beast has been frozen for about 8 months. I mean, all these dishes like surf and turf. I finally found, by the way, what animal at surf and turf comes off of. It's a tiny aquatic Hereford that swims in great herds underwater and can both moo and draw flies underwater. but it took me a long time to find it.
Do you ever go to an ethnic restaurant in the middle of an area where few people of that ethnic persuasion actually live, like a delicatessen in a small town on the prairie? Or
No, my rule is to eat regional specialties or food of ethnic groups that are strong enough to have at least two aldermen. If they don't have two aldermen, I don't go. I would make an exception for on that theory for the Vietnamese and some of the recent immigrants. This country for years had immigration laws that allowed in to the country more Englishmen than wanted to come, more people bringing their vegetables that had been boiled since shortly after the American Revolution to this country, and keeping out anybody who could cook. I mean, there were something like 60 Greeks a year allowed in, something like that. So I was very much in favor of the change of the immigration laws. I think I like to see a lot of Italians let in. You can let in all of Thailand, as far as I'm concerned. And when the American embassy finally was evacuated in Saigon and all the helicopters were above the compound and people were scrambling to get on, I was in front of the television set screaming, "Get the chefs, get the chefs." And I think a lot of them managed to get aboard because I've recently been in, say, Portland, for instance, had a marvelous Vietnamese meal in Portland. Same is true in Minneapolis, where there are a lot of Vietnamese. And in Minneapolis, there wasn't much to do about eating in the old days except make jokes about lutefisk, which is... Lutefisk is a dreadful concoction that people eat to show they're Scandinavian. They all hate it, but it's kind of like teenage circumcision. You have to do it as a kind of a badge of being Scandinavian if you live in Minneapolis. So about the only thing you could do is to eat dreadful food and talk about lutefisk, but now you can eat Vietnamese food. It's been a great change.
You never write about wine and beer, right? And alcohol? I can't remember seeing anything by you on this subject.
I just wrote a column about being a consultant in wine tasting in the Napa Valley in California, consultant of a sort. I was the first person when people were talking in my previous trip to the Napa Valley, or maybe two or three trips ago, people were talking about some similarities in French and white wine, that I noted that Manischewitz Pink Cream Catawba and Chateau Lafite Rothschild both taste a little bit Jewish. But they didn't think that that was true at all and didn't want to let me taste as a taster. But then I found out something that's very interesting. This is really true. Wine experts, blindfolded, normally cannot tell the difference between red wine and white wine. This is absolutely true. A friend of mine in the Napa Valley who manufactures wine, very good wine, it's his business. He did one of these tastings and got 4 out of 7 right, which is not much better than he would do if he just tried flipping a coin. We're not talking about distinguishing Burgundy from Beaujolais or something. We're talking about saying this one's red and this one's white. So in a way, I'm as much of an expert as they are. My younger daughter came home from school one day and said, blindfolded and holding your nose, she always seems to one-up us, you can't tell Coke and 7-Up apart. What she didn't say is how hard it is to drink Coke or 7-Up while you're holding your nose. This is extremely difficult, unless you're one of those people who approaches nose-holding from above, which I've always considered a little effete. It's very hard to make that test. But I think if you did it, you'd find it's difficult to tell. At the same time, I was asked for my advice in the Napa Valley. A friend of mine said he was trying to decide what made his wine attractive to people who knew absolutely nothing about it. People who bought wine according to the label design, or the shape of the bottle or something like that. And he asked me what kind of things I like on labels. I told him a mountain. I like a nice mountain. on a label. I often buy from mountains. I also revealed in this column what a talk show host named Jim Eason told me once in San Francisco about the proper soft drinks with food, which is Coke or Royal Crown with or Pepsi with meat, and 7-Up or ginger ale with fish, and Dr. Pepper with game. This probably would be of some value to if there are any gourmets out there listening.
Have you tried pizza with goat cheese yet?
Well, I was very disturbed about goat cheese for a while in California until I was assured that you don't have to kill the goat to get the goat cheese. I thought all of this goat cheese stuff was dangerous. My wife, Alice, likes goat cheese on pizza, so I have had it now and then, this kind of haute cuisine pizza in California. I don't actually mind it, although I'm not a great pizza fan, no matter what.
From reading your writing, I really always get the impression that you and your wife share a lot of similar tastes in food and a similar adventurousness in your approach to food. I guess that's a lucky thing, huh?
Well, it is. We don't actually, there are a lot of things that we don't share about eating. She, for instance, doesn't like really spicy hot food, and I love really spicy hot food. And I think she, we sometimes say that she is a fancy Eastern girl and I am but a simple lad from the Midwest. And I think she likes haute cuisine more than I do, which I tend to admire more than gloat over. Around the second course, particularly the middle course of a 2 or 3 star French restaurant in France, I find myself admiring the fact that they were able to do that with a pigeon more than I'm really enjoying it. And that isn't true, say, if I were eating in a Provençal restaurant in the south of France. And it either is that I simply have a peasant palate or that I have a limited capacity for butter and an unlimited capacity for garlic. I like to think it's that I have an unlimited capacity for garlic.
Maybe it has something to do with vampires.
Well, it may have something to do with vampires. Of course, the best defense there is Romanian Jewish cooking in New York, which Alice allows me to eat once every 7 years. And they're sometimes called Romanian broilings. And it's a place, most of these places, there are 2 or 3 of them in New York, have schmaltz, that is chicken fat, liquid chicken fat, in a dispenser on the table in the way a diner in New England might have maple syrup, so that you can improve on the chef's excesses. And there's a lot of garlic. That's the Romanian part. And so that what happens is that if the vampire gets through the garlic defense, you hit him with heartburn from the schmaltz. And so I think I feel very safe when I eat that sort of food. But unfortunately, Alice doesn't agree with it and reminds me occasionally of Zero Mostel's great line about Romanian Jewish cooking, which is, it's killed more Jews than Hitler. So she doesn't let me go there very often.
You have writing that you do regularly for The New Yorker magazine as well as for The Nation. And it strikes me that the identity of both of those magazines are so completely different, and their readership's probably completely different, too. Do you ever meet somebody who reads both?
Not very often. I gave a speech a few weeks ago, and somebody asked me about The Nation, and I said that the circulation in the nation consists of 1,200 librarians and 8 unreconstructed old Trotskyites. And after the speech, a man came up and said, I'm one of the unreconstructed old Trotskyites. I don't think there are many of those reading The New Yorker, although there might be. It's a very special readership in The Nation. A lot of old left-wingers who I suppose the character I have in the columns called Harold the Committed is sort of a representative of the subscribers who are very intensely political and often wonder why I'm not more interested in the fate of the Scottsboro boys than I am.
Now tell us about Harold the Committed. When you know a lot of people who are like him. Maybe you could describe the persona that you've created for him.
Well, Harold the Committed is constantly asking me whether I'd like to see the human race as we know it destroyed in a nuclear holocaust, even though I've assured him any number of times I would not like to see the nuclear race, I mean, the human race as we know it destroyed a nuclear holocaust, and have even offered to sign an affidavit to that effect. I tell Harold the committee, even on my bad days, what we call around the house multi-motor days, where the washing machine man says we need a new motor and the automobile repair man says we need a new motor, I don't sit around and say, I'd like to see the human race as we know it destroyed a nuclear holocaust. I say, I thought we just got a new motor for the washing machine. He is constantly worried that I am not sufficiently political and that I'm not raising my daughters with what he calls political content. For instance, we have a big Halloween parade in Greenwich Village where I live. Harold had committed one of my younger daughters to go as Emma Goldman the year that she decided to go as a box of M&Ms. He was very disappointed. And then he wanted my older daughter to go as the danger posed to our society by the military-industrial complex. I said, Hal, see, we just don't have anybody at home who can sew that well. So she went as a chocolate chip ice cream cone with chocolate sprinkles. He's still accusing me constantly of not being a serious person.
We're really short on time, so one last thing I'll ask you. You write a lot about your family in your columns. Does that go over okay in the family? Are they comfortable with that? And you probably draw the line about what you
the
won't
girls,
write about.
I do draw the line in the sense that I obviously don't write about serious things. The girls are comfortable with it. They have a wonderful way of not worrying about it. They don't read what I write, and therefore it doesn't bother them. As I said, Sarah, my younger daughter, is now a little worried that people will think that she still carries a bagel with her when she goes to Chinatown. But I'm careful to keep them kind of caricatures rather than people. And I think they don't mind it. Although when the New Yorker checker called Sarah to check some facts about our time at the Catfish Festival, I heard her say to him, some things he got right and some things he didn't get right.
Calvin Trillin, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
That was Calvin Trillin, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. His latest book about food is Third Helpings. His new book, With All Disrespect, is a collection of his humor columns from The Nation magazine. It's published by Tigner and Fields. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The technical directors for this edition were Ron Barron and Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. The associate producer of Fresh Air is Amy Sallet. Danny Miller and I co-produced the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible by support from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia and its 16 undergraduate, graduate, and professional schools. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.